Very well.
I'd like to take my argument in two steps. First, I plan to address the cost of debt issues that are raised in ACLI's appeal, and then I will turn to the host of issues that are raised by my friends in their cross-appeal. ACLI had two significant debt facilities. One was a note facility that would mature in 2017 and carried an interest rate on its face of 12.5%. The other was a revolving credit facility that it also used as long-term debt that had two components that the parties stipulated to. One was a floating LIBOR component, and the other one was a premium above LIBOR of 3.75%. So when the court reached its decision with respect to the revolver, it looked to the one-month LIBOR, which at the time was 0.26%, and added that to the premium over LIBOR 3.75% to arrive at the 4.01. And our dispute today revolves around the LIBOR component. I want to first talk to you about the court's decision to use the yield to worst on the merger date rather than prior to the announcement of the merger to measure the cost of debt for the notes. I think it's important to bear in mind that none of the experts in this case use that metric. Instead, ACLI's expert used the yield to worst prior to the merger announcement for all debt instruments of either revolver and the notes. She also separately analyzed the revolver and the notes. And again, she did not use the yield to worst on the merger date. Similarly, my friends at IQ also did not use the yield to worst on the merger date. So the court here is all out on its own. I think it's important to...
Which it can be, correct?
The court can reach its own decision. However, I think the court's decision needs to be supported by the evidence. And importantly here, it needs to comply with the statute. And Section 262 teaches to us that you cannot include post-merger value in determining fair value, because the idea here is we're valuing this company as if the merger did not occur. And if you look at our opening brief on page 9, we include a chart that shows how the yield to worst reacted around the time of the merger. And I think you'll see that as soon as the merger is announced, it pops up, it plummets down, and then it comes back up. So the question then becomes, well, why did it do that? And I think there are a few things we can look at as to why the yield to worst fluctuated. One question is, was there something in the macroeconomic environment that changed? Well, we know that the Bloomberg Composite Index of B-rated bonds actually lowered during that same, this is only a 9-week period, mind you.
Excuse me, I just want to make sure I know where you're heading.
Of course.
The rule of law that you're relying on is that it's the statute prohibits inclusion in fair value of any expectation, any value that results from the expectation or accomplishment of the merger.
Exactly. Right?
Your argument is that was what was done here, and therefore was error.
Exactly.
Okay, what is the it that was done here?
The it that was done here is that the yield to worst prior to the merger was 9.6%. After the merger announcement, it plummets to 7.15%. We argue that the reason for that difference is all because the markets, the bond markets, they're reacting to the merger announcement. And that has a...
Okay, but that is not a legal argument. That's an argument, a factual argument, isn't it? That is, it's a contested issue of fact as to whether that number was the result of the market making calculations based on the expectation or announcement of the merger, correct?
I would contend that at best it's a mixed question of fact and law. I mean, initially we would say...
Well, what's the law part of it?
The law part of it is that the court cannot incorporate the value from the merger into fair value.
Right. But was that done here? And that issue has to be, perforce, a factual issue, doesn't it?
I would, again, respectfully disagree with Your Honor and say that I think at best it's a mixed question of how the facts apply to the statute, and this Court has held that mixed questions of fact and law are reviewed de novo.
And well, that, go ahead.
In this case, the Vice Chancellor used figures from the date of the merger. Is that correct?
Right. The merger close date. Exactly. Right.
And that's what the statute calls for. Value the company on the date of the merger.
Right. You're valuing the company on the date of the merger, but excluding any expectation from the merger. And the value impact of using the yield to worst on the merger close date, as opposed to the merger announcement date when it was not impacted, is over $5 a share. So this is a very significant increase in the company's value at a time where there's no evidence that anything other than the merger changed the risk profile of the company. In fact, the only thing my friends can point to are the third quarter financial results. And there's no evidence that this was a dramatic change in the company. It had no impact on the out years of the projections. And it also did not change the projections for 2010, the year the merger closed. And so my friends would say, despite the fact that this radically changed the risk profile of the company, somehow it had no impact on the projections. And I think the two are kind of inextricably, they're intertwined. One goes with the other. If there really was a change in the risk profile of this company because it is doing so much better, as they assert, then one would expect the projections in the out years to similarly increase. But no one has ever asserted that occurred here. So I think the fundamental problem that the court did here is because there's no evidence whatsoever that the yield to worst was affected by anything other than the merger, that the court is incorporating post-merger value. And another key mistake that the
that's really the gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? Whether or not there's no evidence or some evidence, and if there's some evidence, whether it's enough evidence.
I mean, in part, I think we do need to look at the evidence, and the court cites no evidence one way or another as to whether this metric is affected by the merger. And, you know, in fact, our expert testified that it was, in fact, something that was impacted by the merger. And the other thing that the court does to compound this error is the yield to worst is a short-term metric. What the yield to worst is, it's estimating the rate of return that you could get on the notes if you paid the market value of the notes and then kept them until the earliest possible call date. And here the earliest possible call date was July of 2013. And the reason for that is there was a very significant $67 million penalty if the notes were paid off sooner. So the yield to worst is only looking out 2.5 years. And contrast that with the yield maturity, which is looking out much further. It's looking out 7 years. It's asking what the return would be until the notes would be matured. And here, maturity occurred in 2017. And it's a well-established valuation principle by the courts in Delaware, as well as the Pratt and Grabowski treatise and numerous other treatises, that the goal here is to look to the long-term cost of debt, because we're discounting cash flows into perpetuity. So it seems logical you would want to match a long-term cost of debt with a long-term cash flow that you're discounting.
And if, so, would it make a difference if the court used 7.0% consistent with Fuller's testimony as opposed to the 7.15%?
Well, I think Fuller's testimony was simply that he disagreed with the use of the yield to worst on that date because he felt it was a short-term input, and so he says he wouldn't have incorporated that. If your question is as to the difference between the 7.15 versus the 7.0, I believe he was probably just speaking in shorthand. I think the court and Mr. Fuller were speaking of the same metric and the same number. And so the fundamental error here is the court deviates from this well-established valuation principle and uses a short-term metric. And so the proper way to do the analysis, if you're going to use a market-based approach, would be to use the long-term cost of debt from the yield to maturity prior to the merger announcement when it's not affected. The other significant...
Well, that may be a choice. But are you saying that as a matter of law, that's the only way to look at it?
I think there are a lot of ways you can look at the cost of debt. You know, you could look to the bond rating, which certainly the court has done in the past. You could also look to the actual cost of debt, which there's a mountain of case law that's looked to the actual cost of debt. However, if you're going to use the actual cost of debt, there is no decision ever that has applied a market-based approach to one debt instrument and the actual cost of debt for another instrument. And that is problematic here because the notes were actually higher than prevailing rates, whereas the revolver was below prevailing rates. So if you adjust the notes so they are lower and more in line with current rates, but you know, you don't make, you make a actual cost of debt that also is lower with respect to the revolver, you lead to this unreasonably low blended cost of debt. And in this case, the blended cost of debt by the court is significantly below even that used by IQ's expert. In fact, I believe it's over $4 a share in additional value that the court has above and beyond the result we would get to if we used the cost, blended cost of debt assumption of IQ's expert.
Let me interrupt with a kind of a general question. It's my understanding that in an appraisal proceeding, the court is supposed to determine fair value, and there are certain limitations. As you say, it would not be acceptable for the court to include the value that arises out of the expectation of the merger. But if we get past an arguable error like that, aren't we talking about different options, different valuation methods, different valuation numbers that the court is free to accept or reject or modify, and really it's not subject to review as long as it's not without any support, that a factual determination as to what percentage to use or what experts report, what portion of it to use, what discounted method to use, all of those things are within the court's discretion and are reviewable only for an abuse of discretion. Isn't that correct?
Well, I would agree with you as a general matter. The court has quite broad discretion in order to apply valuation methodologies. What the court has to do, though, is, one, comply with the statute's requirement that do not incorporate post-merger value, and also, importantly for what we were just discussing, it has to apply well-established valuation principles. And those well-established valuation principles would say you look to the long-term cost of debt. And to flow into your question about the factual issue, one significant issue with respect to the revolver portion is there is no evidence whatsoever supporting the conclusion that the court reached. There's no evidence at all that the Federal Reserve gave any intent, good or bad, as to what it expected long-term interest rates to do. And in fact, if you look at what the Federal Reserve stated that it intended to keep interest rates low for an undefined extended period. It didn't say how long it was, and it said that it anticipated rates to rise at some point in the future. All the experts, and we cite quite a bit of support for this in our briefing, believe that interest rates were rising and that perhaps as soon as 2013, they expected interest rates to rise quite quickly. And so what the court does that's improper here is, one, it's using a short-term metric again. It's using a one-month LIBOR to estimate what LIBOR is going to be over a long period of time. And there's market-based metrics out there where you can determine what the long-term LIBOR expectations are. And that's done in the swap market. In the swap market, people buy fixed long-term 30-year contracts for three-month LIBOR over a 30-year period, and that could be used here.
But the court chose to use a short-term LIBOR, right?
Right.
And you're saying that is not permitted as a matter of appraisal law?
No, I'm not saying that. I think if the facts supported it, the court could use a short-term LIBOR. For example, if over the long term there was evidence, truly evidence, that rates were expected to be stagnant, in that scenario it would make sense. But here, there's no support for the court's ruling. And the court's whole basis for its belief that rates were going to stay where they are was based on the Federal Reserve statements that it doesn't even have a citation to in the court's opinion, and that there was no evidence in the trial record from which it could base it. And so the court's really...
So you're saying that the court could not choose a short-term LIBOR rate unless there were some expert that said that's what you should use?
I don't think the court is necessarily tied to an expert. I think the court is tied to something in the record. Here, the court went completely outside the record and reached something completely different than what was addressed in any of the briefing in the trial testimony. And so the court went way out of bounds. And not only did the court go way out of bounds, but it's contrary to what the Federal Reserve actually stated.
The court had no difficulty with the methodologies that both experts used, did they?
The court did not follow either expert's comparable companies analysis or the comparable transactions analysis.
The court chose to use the cash flow analysis.
It used the discounted cash flow analysis of ACLI's expert and only made two adjustments to that analysis, which are the two cost of debt issues we're discussing today with respect to the revolver and the notes.
Do you have any issue with that?
We would agree with the court's reliance solely on the DCF methodology here. We have not appealed the court's rejection of the comparable companies analysis or the comparable transactions analysis. And so we think it's perfectly appropriate for the court here in its discretion to rely solely on the DCF analysis. I'd like to turn now to the issues raised by my friends here. First, I would like to talk about the adjustment that the court made to a line item called the Additional Strategic Initiative Savings. This is a line item that if you had in your hands the projections, you would see it appears at the very bottom of the projections. It's a separate line item. And the testimony was that the reason it was at the very bottom of these projections was it was a highly speculative line item that didn't have a lot of support in it. And my friends here say, well, you know, this is de novo standard of review, that what we're really questioning here is whether you can adjust management projections, and as a matter of law, you can't adjust management projections. No court has ever reached that decision, and in fact, even the cases that have rejected post-litigation-driven projections have said that under the right facts and circumstances, if it's supported, the court can do that. And in fact, in the case that my friends primarily rely on, the Seed case, there, the expert essentially kind of rewrote the projections and made some very significant changes, versus here we're just talking about one line item. And that line item is supported by substantial testimony. There's kind of an interesting dynamic here with respect to the testimony, because my friends don't question the credibility of Mr. Noltemeyer or Ms. Bryant, but at the same time, their fundamental challenges to them are really to credibility. It's these guys weren't in the room when they were creating the projections, that they're, you know, have hindsight bias. All of these things are credibility issues that are reviewed for clear error. They're certainly not something that would be reviewed de novo. And so because of the extensive support for the court's decision here to adjust management's projections, I believe it was well within the court's discretion in order to make the 50% adjustment. In fact, the adjustment that ACLI's expert made was quite conservative. My friends in the past have suggested that it was arbitrary because it was a 50% adjustment. But what she testified was that she would personally exclude all of them because they were such a speculative line item. But to be conservative, she gave them 50% weight of testimony. 50% weight. They also focus quite heavily on the testimony of Ms. Bryant and Mr. Noltemeyer, who they say weren't involved. Well, there was someone who testified that was involved, Mr. Pahalski. And in their reply brief, they selectively quote from his testimony. I would strongly encourage the court to actually look at the testimony, because any time he says management's projections are reasonable, he goes on to state they're reasonable, but you have to remember there was significant challenges in there. There were $40 million in unidentified cost savings.
So the court made credibility determinations in its analysis?
The court's opinion specifically found Ms. Bryant and Mr. Noltemeyer to be credible witnesses. Mr. Pahalski did not testify live, but his deposition testimony was before the court and included in the briefing. So there is ample support here, included by the CFO, who was directly involved in the projections and testified that these were speculative. So there's ample support here for the court's decision, and certainly not a basis to believe the court abused its discretion. The other issue that they raise is with respect to the non-cash operating activities line item. And the issue here is that my friends say, well, the I expert didn't include this line item, and it's appropriate to exclude it. But the problem is, if you're going to exclude a line, I need to understand what's in that line item. And their expert did no analysis of why that item should be included or excluded.
Is that a legal issue or a factual issue?
That is a factual issue, and I believe it's undisputed that this is being reviewed for abuse of discretion by my friends. And if you will look at Exhibit A to our reply brief, we include a chart where if you compare the 2009 10-K to the projections, you will see that the bottom line numbers are identical. There's a difference of roughly $3,000 between the two. And so it's realistic to assume that they include the same data but organized differently. And if you look at the difference between the two, you will see where all the differences are. And one of those differences is debt cost amortization. And both sides agree that if the line item does include debt cost amortization, that that should be excluded from the cash flows. So ACLI's expert backed that out. My friends also say, well, if you look at these line items, the number in the actual year is radically different from the number in the projected years. Well, the reason for that is simple. When you look at the deconstruction of the line item, it includes several one-time items. And if you were to exclude those one-time items, you'll see that the numbers are consistent from the early years to the later years. The next issue they raise is respect to beta. I think my friends here are simply mincing words. They say that their expert used multiple sources of beta and that ACLI's expert used a single source, and the court essentially flipped the two and said their expert relied on one beta source and that ACLI's expert relied on multiple sources. I think the testimony is quite clear that ACLI's expert looked at a variety of betas and picked the Barrett beta because it was the midpoint beta, whereas my friend's expert looked at comparable companies' beta and used that to come up with one beta. So it is similar and akin to the Barrett beta. I think the court truly understood what it was doing here, and this is just simple mincing of words. And the problem with relying on the beta advocated by my friend's expert as to what Your Honor raised a moment ago about what analysis did they reject, well, one of the analysis the court rejected was a comparable companies analysis. And my friends haven't questioned that on appeal. Well, by looking at comparable companies' betas, you're using betas from companies that the court has already determined are dissimilar. And so it makes no sense to use that beta.
You're into your reserve time. Would you like to continue or save your time?
Unless any of Your Honors has any specific questions, I would prefer to reserve my time.
Very well.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Mark Wara, representing the appellee and cross-appellant IQ Holdings. I propose to discuss the four issues raised by ACLI in their appeal, and then to turn to the first of our three cross-appeal points, the issue of the cash flow projections. To the extent time permits, I will then also talk about our other two cross-appeal points. So all four of ACLI's appeal points challenge the Chancery Court's determinations concerning the cost of ACLI's debt. By way of introduction to my discussion of those appeal points, I'll say this. Cost of debt is relevant to an appraisal action because it is one of the inputs to the weighted average cost of capital calculation. That WACC calculation provides the discount rate used to determine the present value of the company's anticipated future cash flows. An equally significant input to that very same WACC calculation is the amount of debt. And it's important that the method for determining the cost of the debt match up with the method used to determine the amount of debt. So there are two basic approaches that are typically used to determine the actual cost and actual amount of debt. And in this case, the Vice Chancellor used both methods, one to account for ACLI's revolving debt, the revolving credit agreement, and the other to account for the notes. So the first approach, the approach used with the revolver, is to look at the nominal or stated or coupon interest rate of a debt instrument and use that for the cost. And then you look at the nominal amount or outstanding indebtedness, the book value, for the amount. That's the approach the Vice Chancellor employed in accounting for the revolver debt. The other approach can be used when debt is publicly traded. which, of course, the revolver is not a publicly traded instrument, but the notes were. So the second approach uses the market price of debt to derive two things, a yield and a market value as of the valuation date. That yield is then used as the cost of debt, and the market value is used as the amount of debt. That's the method the Vice Chancellor used to account for the notes in this case. So, turning to the first of ACLI's points on appeal, the Court of Chancery, they say, included an element of value arising from the anticipation of the merger when it used the market yield on the notes to establish the cost of debt associated with those notes. In reality, ACLI disagrees with the Chancery Court's fact-finding about the cost of the notes, and therefore, this is an abuse of discretion point. Under either standard, however, IQ should prevail here. First, there's a fatal inconsistency in ACLI's argument on this point. ACLI suggests that using the price of the senior notes on the merger date to establish the cost of that debt impermissibly incorporates an element of value arising from anticipation of the merger on the theory that the merger announcement affected the price of the notes. But ACLI has always advocated using the price of the notes on the merger date to establish the amount of the debt. And that is, in fact, what the Vice Chancellor did as well. If the merger announcement affected the price of the notes, then by definition, it affected the market value that the ACLI's expert used and that the Vice Chancellor adopted. In reality, ACLI tried to cherry-pick the best of both worlds, using the higher valuation date price of the notes to derive the market to the market value or amount of the debt, and the lower pre-announcement date price of the notes as its benchmark for the cost of the debt. And the Vice Chancellor properly rejected that tactic. Second, there is actually no evidence that the merger announcement affected the price of the notes and therefore the yield or interest rate cost of the notes. ACLI never provided any evidence at trial to support such a claim, and even the chart it supplied for the first time in its post-trial brief doesn't support the argument. ACLI's post-trial chart actually shows that the yield of the notes increased upon announcement of the merger, then dropped sharply in the early part of November, meaning that the price increased in early November. That's why the yield dropped.
Well, so was there any reason for the dramatic change other than the merger announcement?
Yes, there was. The price dropped when ACLI announced its very good third quarter results in its 10Q on November the 5th, 2010. Market reaction to the third quarter results is the more logical explanation for the market price increase of the notes during November.
Were those points argued before the Vice Chancellor, those factual points?
Those points were argued in post-trial briefing.
Okay.
Because it wasn't ever raised during trial itself.
Okay, but they were presented.
Yes.
And I gather I don't recall that there was a finding made on either side of that argument, but your point is there's certainly there's an implicit finding, and there's credible evidence to support it, even if it wasn't articulated in the order. Is that a fair statement?
Well, other than the part about credible evidence, only because this argument wasn't brought up, this argument about look at the yield on the notes over time during 2010, that point wasn't argued until post-trial briefing, so there's no evidence. The ACLI says you can take judicial notice of our chart. Understood. The evidence of the third quarter results, that's certainly in the record at trial. And we simply say the more logical inference from looking at the chart is, well, why did yield go up when the merger was announced, and then go down at the time the third quarter results were.
So you're saying that the inference that your side is relying on is at least equally reasonable, if not more.
If not more. The other point is there is no witness who testified at trial that the merger announcement actually affected the price. It is true that ACLI's expert said that the reason she chose the October date for the yield was so it would be unaffected by the announcement, but she never expressed the opinion that the merger announcement actually affected the price of the notes. On ACLI's second appeal point, the Court of Chancery, in our view, correctly applied the observed and stipulated interest rate on ACLI's revolver as of the merger date. And I did want to respond to one thing that Mr. Farrell said. Mr. Farrell said that the revolver was priced below market versus the notes being priced above market. The notes certainly were an above-market debt, but the revolver was not below market. In fact, the evidence was that on the merger date, contemporaneous with the merger, that revolver rate was brought even lower than it was, than the rate that the vice chancellor used. IQ's argument is that the Court of Chancery properly relied on the observed cost of the revolver at the merger date. The vice chancellor simply was not persuaded by ACLI's experts' predictions about how LIBOR would change in the future, and he explained why he reached this conclusion clearly and logically in the post-trial order at paragraph 9A. Accordingly, and in conformity with other Delaware appraisal decisions like Gilbert and Emerging Technologies, the vice chancellor used ACLI's observed interest rate at the time of the merger, and that was proper. ACLI did not provide sound evidence that LIBOR was likely to change significantly in the future. Its reliance on interest rate swaps and forward treasury rates are not indicators of what LIBOR will be in the future, but rather they incorporate, in addition to that expectation, a premium for inflation and interest rate risk on top of market expectations about LIBOR. And ACLI's expert acknowledged that she could not identify the amount of that premium or whether it changed the nature of the interest rate forward curve to being flat or being upward. ACLI's third point argues, with respect to the cost of the notes, that the Court of Chancery ought to have adopted ACLI's prediction about future interest rate changes. But the Court of Chancery correctly adopted the actual market cost of the notes on the merger date rather than ACLI's calculated long-term cost of debt, and in doing so, it conformed to well-established appraisal law. The key issue here is that interplay between the way of deriving the cost of debt and the way of deriving the amount of debt. The Pratt Treatise, Valuing a Business, notes that it is an error to, quote, to use a cost of debt that is incompatible with the capital structure assumed in the WACC, the weighted average cost of capital. In this case, both the vice chancellor and ACLI's expert included note debt of $404 million in the WACC calculation, deriving that number from the market price of the notes on the valuation date. Ms. Knoll's error in her analysis was in using a cost of debt that was inconsistent with that market value of note debt that she assumed was part of the capital structure. Obviously, because ACLI's notes traded above par, the market was willing to own that debt at a lower yield than the coupon. But instead of using the market yield on the debt at the valuation date, Ms. Knoll used the market yield from 2 months earlier as her benchmark, but without adjusting the amount of debt to be consistent with that other yield. Now, like ACLI's expert, the vice chancellor also used the yield to call as the cost of the notes, but he required that the cost of debt figure had to be derived from the same market data as the amount of debt figure, the price of the notes on the valuation date. So on this appeal, ACLI is really just re-arguing Ms. Knoll's opinion that 7.15% was lower than she believed the long-term cost of debt should be. Ms. Knoll's analysis ignored ACLI's actual market cost of debt in favor of an assigned long-term cost of debt based on her own expectations.
Well, I thought at least part of the argument was there's no evidence to support the 7.15.
Now, the 7.15 is a calculation done. I think both parties agree that that 7.15 number is the yield to worst if you assume a market price, if you take the market price on the valuation date of those notes, which was 117.5. It was 17.5 above par. And so the yield to worst or yield to call, which is the refinancing opportunity available in July of 2013, you just calculate out how much, if you buy a note at 117.5 and you get the benefit of the refinancing premium and the benefit of the coupon rate through that date, that translates into a 7.15% yield to yield. And I don't think there's any dispute about that calculation being correctly done. Did I answer
yes.
the question you had? So the court's decision to apply the actual market cost of debt rather than the cost of debt based on Ms. Knoll's prediction about the future is supported by the record and by the law. Delaware courts consistently hold that a company's actual cost of debt is the appropriate measure rather than a manufactured long-term cost of debt like Ms. Knoll used. Emerging Communications is such a case. Gilbert versus MPM Enterprises, that's such a case. Finkelstein versus Liberty Digital, that case as well stands for that proposition. The finding was consistent with what Mr. Fuller, IQ's expert, asserted was the appropriate cost of debt to use for the notes if one agreed with Ms. Knoll's approach about using the market value on the valuation date to establish the amount. And even Ms. Knoll agreed that 7.15% was the realistic cost of the notes on the merger date. That's at Appendix A, page 323 of the record, page 394 in the transcript when you get to that page of the record. Turning to the fourth point, it's not entirely clear to me what ACLI's fourth point of error is, nor how ACLI preserved that claim of error at trial. However, to the extent ACLI now argues that the Court of Chancery ought to have used ACLI's credit rating to estimate the cost of debt for ACLI, ACLI first made that argument when it moved to re-argue the Chancery Court's post-trial order. And we submit it's been waived. Nonetheless, the Court of Chancery correctly determined a blended interest rate of 5.84% by accounting for both the note and the revolver as of the valuation date. Simply put, there is no reason to use a credit rating to infer a cost of debt when the market has already directly valued the specific debt instrument under consideration. And here we say ACLI's argument is also factually wrong, because in reality the credit rating for ACLI's notes around the merger date was actually a B+, which ACLI admits in its brief. Following ACLI's reasoning, that credit rating suggests that the cost of debt for the notes should be lower than the 7.15% that the vice chancellor used, according to ACLI's own exhibit, which shows you what a debt with that kind of credit rating, what yield you would expect from it. And that exhibit at page A772 of the appendix suggests it should be 6.37%, not 7.15%. Plus, if the revolver had been rated, and of course it wasn't because it's not a public debt, it would have been a higher rating than that because it's senior to those notes. Had the issue been fairly raised at trial, we could have had expert evidence to debate these issues, but I think it is also clear from the inferences from the later evidence presented that this is not a valid appeal point. I'd like to turn now to our cross-appeal and focus my attention at first, and maybe only on our appeal point about the strategic initiative cost savings and what the Chancery Court did with that. We suggest that the Court of Chancery contravened settled Delaware law by adopting ACLI's experts' post-merger adjustments to ACLI's management projections. We suggest this is an over review because we say the Court of Chancery erred in applying the legal precept in emerging communications that an appraisal should rely on a company's most recent contemporaneous management forecasts unless there are compelling reasons to the contrary.
I understand that the case law says that there's a preference for contemporaneous management prepared projections. Is there any case that holds that there is an absolute prohibition?
No. And we're not suggesting there is an absolute prohibition. We are suggesting that the case law suggests that you should use management's projections unless there are compelling reasons to the contrary.
All right. So it doesn't follow that the issue is whether the Court of Chancery abused its discretion in adopting the valuation, the projections that it relied upon?
Well, we think that the order suggests that the Court of Chancery actually misunderstood the law on this point, because the Vice Chancellor did cite emerging communications in his post-trial order, but he cited it for a very different proposition. He cited it for the proposition that contemporaneous management projections are often used as a starting point.
Well,
for
my question is whether the standard of review is abuse of discretion.
No, I think that I think we win both ways, but I think the standard of review here ought to be de novo. Because
how if there's no blanket prohibition?
Because the standard of review should be de novo if the Court of Chancery erred in applying a legal precept. And our argument is when he read emerging communications for the notion that it should be a starting point, when in fact the court did use the language starting point in emerging communications, but followed it by the words, the court disagrees. And I think the Vice Chancellor was mistaken about the importance that the cases put on using management projections and the high bar you have to get over to deviate from those. I recognize I may not be winning that argument, but I think we win on abuse of discretion too, Your Honor. Our complaint here is about the Court of Chancery's decision to adopt the adjustments ACLI's expert made to management projections by removing 50% of management's strategic initiative savings from the cash flows projected by management. Everybody used and recognized that the July projections were the most recent forecasts. And the evidence about those projections from ACLI was, from ACLI's own witnesses, was they were based on the best data available, that senior management and the board had reviewed those projections and considered them a plausible and practical plan, that the company reasonably expected at the merger date to execute that plan, and that ACLI represented at the merger date in its proxy statement that the forecast, with the strategic cost savings included, was based on the company's best information, good faith judgment, and they knew of nothing to suggest the projections were misleading or inaccurate. Nonetheless, Ms. Knoll discarded half those projected cost savings, and she did so without speaking to anybody in management who was involved in forecasting those savings. She only spoke to three people, the general counsel, who had not been involved at all, Ms. Bryant, who was a director of financial planning, who helped to assemble the spreadsheet models used to capture the projections, but didn't have a role in developing them or the assumptions. She just took the information she was given and modeled it. And finally, Mr. Noltemeyer, the corporate controller, who also wasn't involved in the strategic cost savings projections. Ms. Knoll's decision to reject or eliminate half of those cost savings was founded on two rationales that the Delaware cases expressly reject. She relied on Ms. Bryant's view that the savings would be hard to capture. But Ms. Bryant admitted that her view was based on post-merger developments. That kind of hindsight bias is a principal reason the Delaware courts reject post-merger adjustments. For example, the Seed-Cinerama case notes that management projections by definition are not tainted by post-merger hindsight compared to post hoc litigation-driven forecasts that have the untenably high probability of containing hindsight bias. Second, Ms. Knoll admitted that her valuations were done for the purpose of litigation, which she said was different from what management would do. When she was asked whether she'd had the opportunity to come to a better judgment than management had about whether these cost savings could be achieved, she said, quote, I was engaged to come to a different kind of judgment than what management was coming to. My job was to make a judgment as to what was suitable for valuation purposes, not what was suitable for running a company, close quote. As this court said in MG Bank Corporation, the requirement in an appraisal action is to value the company as a going concern based on the operative reality of the company as of the time of the merger. That is, value the business as it was being run.
Your time is up. Thank you very much.
Had a few brief points in rebuttal. First, I would point out that with respect to the yield to worse, there was no factual determination by the trial court one way or another as to whether the yield to worse was affected by the merger. So that simply isn't there. My friends also say that, well, the issue of whether the yield to worse was affected by the merger is not in the trial record. I would submit that's also untrue. If you look at Appendix 221, this is the testimony of ICLI's expert. She explained that at trial, she selected the yield to worse prior to the merger announcement date because, quote, that was a rate that was unaffected by the transaction, with the purpose of this exercise being that I did not want to have any impact of the transaction affect the analysis of the long-term cost of debt. Then, if you look at Appendix 336 in our opening brief, we specifically point out that the yield to worse plummeted after the merger announcement and stayed in an artificially depressed state until the merger was completed on December 21st. So I would submit that issue was certainly raised below. Another issue that my friends raise is they say, well, the cost of the revolver that the court used was the cost on that date. I think it's important for the court to bear in mind that the LIBOR rate was floating, meaning if the LIBOR rate was 0.26% on the merger date and rose to 5% the next day ACLI was paying 5%. They weren't paying the 0.26%. And that's why it's important to look at long-term interest rates, which is consistent with the valuation traces. Another issue I would like to raise for the court with respect to their cross-appeal is my friends have repeatedly stated, in referencing Mr. Pulhowski's testimony, that he had testified that management's projections were reasonable. I will point the court to B B-302 and B-296. And there he testified that, quote, the projection had significant challenges incorporated into them, as we discussed, in terms of cost savings. That refers to the unidentified cost savings, the line item our expert gave 50% credit to, and a fairly significant improvement in the overall market conditions. Unless your honors have further questions, I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and recess.